From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, the Billy Meyer UFO Chronicles. Some sad news to report tonight. Coast to Coast guest Paul Guercio, who was part of the Merlin Project with Dr. George Hart, has died of a heart attack. He was a nationally respected futurist. And, of course, the Merlin Project engaged in predicting the future. It was an amazing series of shows we did with Dr. George Hart and Paul Guercio. Paul has passed on. He had a stroke several months ago, and that contributed to this. He will be missed. Here's what's happening. Someone is finally listening to us as President Donald Trump has signed an executive order to study the risks of an electromagnetic pulse that could potentially disrupt or damage technology and critical U.S. infrastructure. How many years have we been talking about this? Some lawmakers and scientists have long worried that a rogue nation, terrorist group, or a solar flare from the sun could knock out the U.S. electrical grid. The president sees this too, and he's on it. I've got to tell you, I'm impressed. Finally, the U.S. president is doing something about this, because the study will show that there are major risks from either a solar flare, a big X flare, or an EMP, an electromagnetic pulse detonated by a nuke in the atmosphere. Let's get this grid fixed. Attorney General William Barr plans to issue a public version of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's report on the investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election within weeks, they say, not months. Barr released his own summary of the report findings on Sunday, but said he needed more time to review the report to determine just how much of it could be made public. Well, as you already know, no obstruction of justice charges against the president. Let's check in with Howard Bloom, who's been on this story with us for the last couple of years. Howard, when's the media going to give this thing up?
Well, not anytime soon, because none of the shoes have dropped yet. And the real question is Trump under the influence of a malign foreign power, an adversary? What we have is, we don't have the Mueller report, we have the Barr letter. And the Barr letter is highly suspect, and so will be that summary that Barr gives us, trying to reveal what's in the Mueller report. And why? Because on June 8th, 2018, William Barr sent a 19-page memorandum to Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, hoping it would get to President Trump. Now, Barr was subtly applying for the job of Attorney General. How would Barr get the president's attention? By agreeing to be everything that Jeff Sessions was not, by promising to be the president's virtual slave. And Barr put this in terms of the Constitution. In essence, he said that the Constitution gives the president almost dictatorial powers. Wrote Barr about the president, quote, "He alone is the executive branch. As such, he is the sole repository of all executive powers conferred by the Constitution. A special investigator like Robert Mueller does not answer to an independent judicial department," said Barr. But Mueller answers to the president and to the president only. Explained Barr, the full measure of law enforcement authority is placed in the president's hands, and no limit is placed on the kinds of cases subject to his control and supervision, which means one of those cases subject to the control and supervision of the president is the Mueller investigation. And Barr implied that the president can do anything he wants with the investigation's report, including hiding it from the public. What's more, said Barr, the attorney general and the Judicial Department staffers are the president's servants. As Barr put it, while the president has subordinates, the attorney general and DOJ lawyers, they are merely his hand. As for conflict of interest, the president is immune from such things. Explained Barr, in 1974, the Justice Department concluded that the conflict of interest laws cannot be construed as applying to the president. President Trump was furious with Jeff Sessions for not seeing that the primary duty of attorney general is protecting President Trump. And more, President Trump was furious at Sessions for not going after the president's enemies, Hillary Clinton, Andrew McCabe, Bruce Orr, Nellie Orr, and the other alleged deep state plotters who President Trump and his followers are convinced were plotting to torpedo Trump from the beginning, not to mention Barack Obama. In essence, in his memo, William Barr promised he would use the Justice Department to attack the president's enemies. So in the eyes of Democrats, Barr's letter is likely to be just what the president wants it to be. Not a genuine summation of the Mueller report, but a cover-up. There's one more thing, and it's extremely important. William Barr's weekend letter to the public about the Mueller report says the Mueller investigation concluded that there is no criminally prosecutable behavior in Donald Trump's relationship with Russia. But accepting an all-expense-paid trip to Russia with your wife in 1987 is not a crime. It's tourism. Taking out ads in the Washington Post, the New York Times, and the Boston Globe 5 months after that trip, ads promoting the Kremlin's goal that it's time to break up the Western alliance, is not a crime. It's freedom of speech. Being bailed out of bankruptcy by $2 billion of Russian money laundered through a German bank in 2008 is not a crime. It's taking out a loan. Removing a plank from the Republican Party platform that condemns the Russians for taking over Crimea is not a crime. It's leadership. Saying you want to remove as many sanctions as you can on the Russians is not a crime. It's the exercise of judgment. And working to break up NATO is not a crime. It's foreign policy. The problem will come if one of Trump's enemies in Congress concludes that all of these, plus a dozen more, may be treason, and Democrats are convinced that the dozen more is hidden in two places, plain sight and the Mueller report.
But Howard, we got to move on with this country. We can't keep doing this.
Well, unfortunately, we have a president who dwells on past scars. So the president, you know, keeps repeating the line that there was no collusion. And that brings us straight back to this issue over and over again. Plus, if the president indeed is under the influence of a hostile foreign power, that's a problem we have to be considering.
Well, I don't think he is, but we will monitor the situation. Howard Bloom, is Howard's website, of course, is his name, howardbloom.net. A mysterious syndrome that makes marijuana users violently ill is starting to worry doctors. A new study documented a sharp rise in emergency room visits linked with marijuana following legalization in Colorado. One of the key drivers of the emergency room visits was a mysterious syndrome characterized by severe nausea and repeated vomiting. Little is known about the condition called cannabinoid hypernemorrhous syndrome, or CHS. The only known way to cure CHS is to stop using pot, they say. Researchers still aren't sure what causes it. Just a little news you can use. A third of British wild bees and hoverflies are in decline, according to a new study. If the current trend continues, some species will be lost from Britain altogether, according to the scientists, and it could happen here in the States. Scientists warn that the loss of nature could create problems in years to come, including the ability to grow food crops. The consumer confidence level fell sharply in March, extending a recent up and down pattern that reflects greater worries about the U.S. economy. Let's turn to registered investment advisor Mish Michael Shedlock on this one. Mish, what do you think?
Hey, George, there's all kinds of recession signals here, and I want to talk about those here. But first, I want to say I absolutely agree with you. It's time to move on about this Trump-Russia thing. I've got some pretty high-powered attorney friends in D.C. They cannot stand Trump, but they looked at that investigation and they said, quote, it's all over. Now, back to the economy here. So you and I and some of my friends are in agreement on that. The big recession signal that's happened in the last 2 weeks, the yield curve, the three-month interest rate is inverted with 10 years. George, that has preceded the last six out of six recessions. I don't believe it's different this time. I see all kinds of reports. Every time we see this kind of situation with the dot-coms, with housing, there's somebody that comes out and says it's different this time for this reason. But I'm looking at bond yields over in Europe, negative again, 10-year yields negative in Europe. Corporate bonds with negative yields in Europe, people are looking for safe harbors for their investment. I don't think the shoe has dropped here yet, and we've talked about this before. I don't think we're necessarily going to see the job losses that we saw in the last recession. Everyone's saying, well, we're not going to repeat the housing bubble. I agree. We're not. This recession's going to be a little bit different. It's going to be about junk bonds imploding, not just housing. The job market might not be as bad, but the stock earnings reports, if the job market is not bad, are going to be horrific. That's how I see it playing out, George.
All right, my friend, Mish Shedlock, registered investment advisor. A Southwest Airlines Boeing 737 MAX 8 plane, now that's the same model that has been grounded after two recent crashes, made an emergency landing this afternoon at Orlando International Airport. There were no passengers aboard. The two pilots were flying to California to drop off the jet because they've been grounded when they encountered engine problems about 10 minutes after takeoff. Scary situation there. A UFO seen plummeting towards Earth has left Air Force bosses baffled. Footage filmed in Anchorage in Alaska shows what looks like two plumes of black smoke trailing a mysterious object, which appears to have a light guiding its way. A variety of military aircraft operate out of the nearby base there, but the spokespeople say the sighting has nothing to do with them. In a moment, we're going to talk about the simulation hypothesis. Are we living in a matrix? We just might. Rizwan Virk back with us on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Let me tell you a little bit about our special guest tonight and what an incredible show we've got for you in store tonight. Rizwan Virk, of course, has written the book called The Simulation Hypothesis, an MIT computer scientist, showing why AI, quantum physics, and Eastern mystics all agree we are in a video game. That's how he thinks we are living. And, you know, others have said that, too. I want to read a blurb that our very dear friend Danian Brinkley, who has died four times and come back to talk about it, writes, "I have learned that we live, teach, learn, and love in a virtual world. In this book, Riz Virk combines the mind of a scientist with the heart of a mystic using video games to explain the virtual reality that we live in." I'm going to bring Danian in. He was just with me in Everett, Washington at our sold-out show. Danian, you did a great job out there, by the way.
Oh, thank you very much, George, but so did you.
It was fun. So we've got Riz on the line. I'm going to bring him in a second, but you wrote a blurb on this. It's an incredible theory, isn't it?
Let me tell you something, George. After this last experience, the way that Riz has put this together, and it's exactly the way I wrote, because Riz is a person that's not only a smart scientist, but he is spiritually focused and given back. And the way he takes kids who are gamers, you know, every kid we have, either our children or our grandchildren, are playing games. And I looked at what Riz was doing, and to see the opportunity for a parent or a grandparent to get a book in the hands of children who are gamers so that they connect with gaming to spirituality, Riz has done a fabulous job.
He sure has. And Riz, I want to bring you in now and let you say hi to Danian before he moves off. Go ahead, Riz. Go ahead. Danian's on with you.
Hi, George. Hi, Danian.
Hey, Riz.
And thank you again for the blurb, Danian. Appreciate it.
Oh, yeah, and thanks for being on it, Riz. Knock 'em dead.
All right, he'll do it. Thanks. Danian Brinkley, he did a great job in Everett, Washington. Riz, do we live in a video game, a matrix?
Well, that's, you know, what the book is all about. And it's a topic that, you know, 20 years ago, on March 31st, 1999, you know, the movie The Matrix came out. And that's, I think, the most popular science fiction movie or novel about this idea that we might all live in a video game. And back then, I think we all took it as straight science fiction. But since then, a lot of people, including scientists, technologists like Elon Musk, philosophers, religious scholars, have said, you know what, there may be more to this than just science fiction. That, you know, as we delve into reality, we're finding more and more anomalous findings that make us think that we may be part of a computed, simulated world. So, you know, my conclusion is that it's more likely than not that we live in some type of a simulation. And this is something that myself, as a video game designer, I started to think about how we build video games. And the more I opened up the box on how the physical world works, as well as looking at a lot of the Eastern texts and a lot of the Western religious traditions as well, I realized that that model fits very well in both the scientific and the religious or spiritual side. So it's one of the few models that I can talk with people at MIT about from a scientific perspective. And, you know, I can talk to people in the spiritual world or in the religious world, and they all get it.
Well, you know, living in a matrix might explain why we can't explain why we're here and how we got here. It might be the most logical possibility.
Well, that's right. And, you know, I've known people who were atheists, but then when they started to think about the simulation hypothesis that we're living inside this reality, so we can't really see what's going on outside of this reality. And they said, well, you know, maybe atheism isn't necessarily the answer. Maybe it's being agnostic, or, you know, the beings outside the simulation would look to us, you know, more like gods or angels. than people who are inside the simulation with us. So, you know, it ends up being a very logical way to explain lots of things, including, you know, we'll talk more about synchronicity,
mm-hmm.
which is something we talked about, you know, on this show when I was on a few years ago with my last book.
6 years ago. Can you believe that?
Yeah. quite a while ago. And you know, it turns out synchronicity ties, you know, very much into this idea that we may be in a simulated reality and we're recognizing things that might have happened before.
Riz, can't you stop time if we're living in a matrix?
Well,
or slow it down?
Yeah, you know, theoretically, the people that run the simulation could do that. But those of us who are inside the simulation, right, for us, we wouldn't know that time has been slowed down.
All right, so my first video game I ever played, I'll admit it, was Pong. Just watching this little dot going back and forth on a television screen, boop, boop. And that was it. And all of a sudden, things started getting a little more sophisticated. Now they're amazing. How do you guys come up with this?
Well, you know, it's been a progression of technology over the years. And, you know, I mentioned Elon Musk earlier, and, you know, he said something a few years ago at a conference, and he said, you know, 40 years ago we had Pong, which was really two dots and a, or two dashes and a dot. And today we have virtual reality and augmented reality. And it's true, we have, you know, World of Warcraft, we have Fortnite, which, you know, if we don't play it, then our kids or nephews or grandkids, as Daniel said, are definitely out there, you know, playing Fortnite. And so you have these very realistic looking 3D models. And, you know, all of that happened over time. It didn't go from Pong to Fortnite, you know, in a year. It took a few decades. And, you know, in the book, I have a section that's looking at the computer science and saying, how would you build something like the Matrix? And we'd have to go through all these different stages. And the first stage is like these text adventure games where there's a world in the computer. You can't really see it, but it's there and you can explore it. And, you know, I won't go through all the stages now, but as we get to MMORPGs or massively multiplayer role-playing games, we get into these shared environments where multiple people are connected in the computers. And that there are these 3D models. So the whole world is stored as information, which gets rendered on everybody's computer. Or, you know, in the case of video games that I've made, it's been on the mobile phone. And so we've got this kind of information going back and forth in this shared world. And it's opened up a whole new set of possibilities for how you can interact with other people. But at the same time, we're all looking at it from our own computers, and we're seeing only a piece of the world that's rendered, you know, when we're there. So it's been an interesting progression of technology, leaps and advances. And I'd say the history of computers and the history of video games are pretty intertwined. I mean, the first AI that was ever made was actually a chess-playing computer from Professor Claude Shannon at MIT back in the 1950s. And if you look at the computing power we have today, a lot of that developed because of video games. We needed faster processors. So GPUs, graphics processing units, were invented for video games. So, you know, chat, there's a lot of, you know, chatbots out there. All those were invented, you know, inside video games. So the video games is a key part of all the technology that we have around us, video games and entertainment.
Now, if we're living in a simulation, I mean, we feel pain, you know, we hurt, we cry, we have emotion. How does that happen if we're all simulated?
Well, if you think of a video game, and let's say you're inside World of Warcraft, right? You have a character, and that character might have certain attributes, right? They may have a certain strength, they may have a certain intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is true in video games or even tabletop games like Dungeons and Dragons.
Sure.
I'm old enough that I used to play those with a character sheet. But inside the video game, your character can still be injured, so there's still rules that apply inside that world. And we refer to that as kind of the physics engine and the game rules that apply. So, you know, in this reality, we have some biological processes that are creating our bodies. And so we still have to, for the most part, except for glitches in the Matrix, which we can talk about later, you know, we're subject to those rules. And so that's why we hurt. And, you know, would a video game be interesting if your character couldn't lose any health, or if you were just an invincible character that could do everything? Well, that wouldn't make for a very interesting game.
No, but it'd be a fun life.
It would be for a while, but then we might get bored, right?
All right, Riz, stay with us. We're going to take a quick break, but we will come back and talk more. His latest book is called The Simulation Hypothesis, and MIT computer scientist shows why AI, quantum physics, and Eastern mystics all agree that we are in a video game. Think about those possibilities. Well, next hour, we'll have you chime in and take your phone calls with Riz Virk as we talk about the simulation hypothesis. Amazing story how we could be living in a matrix, in a video game, in a simulation. Jump aboard next hour when we take calls. George Norrie back with you, along with our special guest, Rizwan Virk, with his book called The Simulation Hypothesis, and MIT computer scientist shows why AI, quantum physics, and Eastern mystics all agree we are in a video game. How universal is that agreement, Riz?
Well, I'd say that, you know, that this model of the world that we are inside a video game is something that scientists and mystics can agree upon, but there's differences in how they approach, you know, the topic. So I think one of the big questions is whether we are what we would call PCs, player characters in a video game, or NPCs or non-player characters who are AIs that you might interact with inside the game.
Interesting.
So I think that's an area where there's a lot of difference. And this is where, you know, I realized that I was really onto something when writing this book. I wrote an article about it earlier, but, you know, some of the scientists will say, well, that just sounds a lot like religion, you know, as you start to talk about consciousness outside the video game, coming in and playing a character or inhabiting. And then some of the guys on the more religious side would say, well, that sounds, you know, a little too scientific, that we're just a bunch of AI. That can't be the case. But, you know, when you've got this kind of disagreement, you know, with one concept kind of rubbing both ways, it both, you know, works for both, but it also raises some interesting questions. So, you know, one of the reasons the simulation hypothesis, which is, you know, what we call this theory now, 20 years after the Matrix, has been taken seriously is there was a professor at Oxford named Nick Bostrom, and he put out a paper, Are You Living in a Computer Simulation? Now, he hadn't even seen the Matrix and was not a video game guy. But he wrote this paper in a well-respected, you know, philosophy journal, and his point was more of a statistical argument. He said, suppose there's a civilization somewhere in the galaxy that is able to get to the point of creating a hyper-realistic simulation like a Matrix. Well, how many simulations would they create? They could create as many as they wanted. All you would have to do is spin up another computer system, another server in our own parlance, right? And you could literally have billions or trillions of beings in each of these worlds on each of these servers. So therefore, the number of simulated beings is way more than the number of real biological beings in the galaxy. Therefore, we are more likely to be a simulated being than a real being just by virtue of looking at the numbers.
What happens, Riz, if the simulator shuts off the game, basically?
Well, that's an interesting question, right?
Yes.
If you look at some of the old Indian texts, you know, they talk about the cycles of creation, right? And the way that MMORPGs work, if you look at games like EVE Online or even World of Warcraft, they'll have certain servers that have a storyline that's going for a period of time. And things will happen in that game, and then they'll end that server or that storyline. Or in the ancient Indian texts, you know, they talk about ending that cycle of creation. So, you know, that's one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it is what if they stop and rewind the simulation and change things? And so, you know, as part of my research for this book, I interviewed Tessa B. Dick, who was the wife of Philip K. Dick, the science fiction writer.
Right.
And, you know, she says that he believed firmly that we were inside some kind of computer-generated reality. And, in fact, you know, a lot of his novels and novellas were based on this idea that what we're seeing around us isn't real. In fact, he said he remembered a different timeline when, you know, if you've seen The Man in the High Castle, the Amazon series that's really popular now, or read the book, it describes a world where Germany and Japan won the Second World War and not the Allies. And so, you know, he believed he remembered that timeline and that whoever was running the simulation ended up rewinding it because they didn't like the outcome, and then moved it forward again.
Well, this is an amazing thing. Now, does it also step on the grounds of religion? Because, you know, we've talked about religion for a little bit, but does what does this do about our belief in God, for example?
Well, you know, I find that it's actually fairly consistent with what different religious traditions have been telling us, right? So, you know, if we start with what I call the Western religions, right, the Abrahamic line of Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, you know, what's the first thing in the Bible? You know, God said, let there be light, and there was, right? And when you turn on a computer simulation, what is it you're doing? You're illuminating the pixels of what I call the rendered world. And so you actually are basically turning on the light. You know, a lot of scientists have said, you know, they don't believe in the religious traditions because it says God created the world in 6 days. Well, of course, that seems ludicrous from a scientific point of view unless you adopt the simulation hypothesis, in which case 6 days, I mean, if the Earth wasn't around, that could be six cycles of anything. So all computer simulations have this idea of a clock speed, which is how off, you know, what is the smallest discrete step inside the simulation that you can see. You can't do anything less than that. And so that's usually based on the microprocessor that the computer simulation is running on. But it could represent a year. It could represent a day. But if you had to spin up a whole new world, you could certainly see it taking six clock cycles to generate algorithmically, you know, all of the different parts of the world that you would need to generate. But that's not all. As you look at these religions more deeply, like in Christianity and Judaism, there's this idea of the Book of Life, which is about the deeds that you've done in this life and whether you're going to heaven, purgatory, or hell. And actually, in the Quran, in the Islamic traditions, they're even more explicit. They call it the Scroll of Deeds. So they have two angels that are sitting there recording everything that you do, and then after you die, you are shown those deeds. Now, we just had Danyon Brinkley on, right? And, you know, Danyon had a near-death experience. And when
he's had like four of them now.
He had like four of them now, right? And when he describes it, he describes the panoramic life review, where you not only see what happened, but you see it from the other person's point of view, right? And that is very much what's described in these texts, particularly with the Scroll of Deeds, where they say you have to see what impact your deeds have. Okay, so what does this have to do with video games? Well, just before I started writing this book, I was working with a video game company, and what we were doing is we were recording what was happening inside the game. So you might have a particular play where one player or character, you know, shoots another. Well, we could record it in three dimensions, in the 360, and we could play it back so that you could see it from the point of view of the guy that got shot.
Amazing.
And so that almost, that's probably the only way for something like that to be implemented after we die, if we're going to be shown these scenes from different points of view. Somebody has to be recording them somewhere. So it's very much like the screen capture that happens in video games today, but obviously on a, you know, more of a holographic level and a more sophisticated level. But it actually ties pretty well to that idea. And then, you know, do we really have two angels each just recording our deeds? That would be like 14 billion angels. If you were God and you were going to set that up, you would probably have those be more like AI or functions. They're just recording what you do so that it can be played back later, so that you wouldn't have to necessarily need conscious beings for every single angel, which means messenger, right, in the as you do the translation, but whereas you might have guardian angels that are more conscious beings that are guiding you. So, you know, as we talk about particularly the Western religious traditions, you know, the simulation hypothesis fits very well this idea that there is a here, which is where we are now, and then there is a hereafter, after we leave this place. And so the soul kind of uploads or downloads into the body and then uploads out of the body at death, and then gets to see all of the things that have been recorded in this video game, you know, while we were playing it.
Riz, while you were on hold, I was talking about the death of one of our coast-to-coast guests who has passed on. Now, if this were a simulation, a video game, what has happened to him? Did the simulator or the game runner just decide to take him out?
Well, you know, so this gets into...
He's out of the game now.
He's out of the game this time around, right? But if you're playing a video game, you would choose a character, and you might choose for that character to have a certain number of quests or tasks that have to be done and challenges along the way. And then, you know, you at some point your character might die. You're still there watching the video game, but your character
is gone.
Is gone. But the other characters are still there, right? But they don't know that you're still watching, right? So if we do live in a video game, then, you know, the colleague that has passed on, just like Danian in his case, right, before he went to the beings of light, you know, he could see himself. It was sort of an out-of-body experience where he could see everything that was going on. And that's been described by a lot of people who've gone through that experience.
What does quantum physics teach us about all of this?
Well, that's where it got, you know, really interesting. So, you know, my background is as a video game designer, and so I started to take this seriously as I saw how high-fidelity video games were being. I was playing a ping-pong game a few years ago, a virtual reality ping-pong game, and it started to feel so real that I decided to put the paddle down on the table and lean against the table. Now, there was no table.
was there a paddle?
There was no paddle. It was the controller that I was
using.
So it fell to the ground, and I almost fell over. So that was, you know, one of my conversion experiences, saying, okay, with virtual reality technology, we're getting there. We're not there yet. There's still, like, 6 or 7 stages we'd have to go before we could build a matrix. But so in video games, the reason we can do 3D rendering, if you go back to the days of you know, Space Invaders, and I used to play a racing game on the Atari called Pole Position, right? Those were not fully 3D worlds, and the processors were not fast enough. And so what happened was, in the 90s, there was a game called Doom that came out. I don't know if you've played it, but probably some of the listeners have seen it. It was really popular. It was the first game that was really popular that had a 3D perspective, where you felt like you were shooting other people, but you could see it from the point of view of the character. And before that, it would take too much processing power to render all the pixels of the world. So the golden rule in computer programming of video games, and this is something I learned over time as I started to build games, is you have to optimize. You only render the pixels that are being observed. So you'd look at where the character is in the room, and, you know, if there's like a stair or there's a bureau and there's something behind it, you don't have to render the pixel behind the dresser. You just have to render exactly what can be seen from the point of view of the character. And that's why we have 3D games today. Okay, so now how does this tie to quantum physics? Well, one of the biggest mysteries in quantum physics is this idea of the particle-wave duality, the idea that a particle can be both a wave and a single particle. By a wave, it can be a probability of a bunch of different places that the particle might be, and that wave is said to collapse down to a single possibility. Probably an easier way to understand it is the now infamous Schrodinger's cat, right, which you've probably heard of, where the cat is in a box with some radioactive material, and he has a 50% chance of being dead and a 50% chance of being alive. So what quantum physics teaches us is, when you open the box and look at the cat, that's when one of those possibilities becomes real. Now, that's a little counterintuitive, because we would think the cat is either alive or dead. We just don't know, because we haven't looked in the box yet, right? But quantum physics tells us that both of those possibilities exist. The cat is both dead and alive until we observe it. And so the golden rule in quantum physics is, only when something is being observed does the probability wave collapse from, you know, a bunch of random possibilities to what we actually see as the real world. And so this happens at the quantum level, but it's a lot easier to understand at kind of the level of the cat, or if we were in a movie theater, the probability wave would be, I could be sitting in any one of these seats, and it collapses down to one chair, which is one single possibility. Well, it turns out that whole process is called quantum indeterminacy. And in quantum physics, nobody knows why it exists, but they know that it does exist.
That it does exist, yeah.
And it turns out it's the same golden rule that I just talked about in video games, which is, you render that, only that which is being observed.
Now, you talked a little bit about synchronicity before, and of course synchronicity being what they call the coincidence of time, and I don't believe in coincidences at all. So where does synchronicity fit into this?
Well, that's a really interesting one, and it's kind of, you know, close to my heart, because I've been thinking about synchronicity in different ways, and how synchronicity often gives us clues as to where we might want to go. So if you think of yourself in a video game, the way modern video games work is, characters have quests that they have to go and achieve. And, you know, in a video game, the quest might be, oh, go find the map of to the Goblin King, go kill the Goblin King, get the treasure, right? But in a video game like we have, the quests might be, okay, you know, you are meant to write this book, you are meant to make this movie, you are meant to meet this person. So those are very different kind of quest. And so I view synchronicity as the glitch in the matrix, which is a term, you know, they used in that movie, but that gives us a sense that we should be moving in a certain direction. And so, you know, Jung first defined the idea of a synchronicity, and we think of it as a meaningful coincidence, right? And as you said, maybe there are no coincidences, but Jung also used a more technical term for defining synchronicity. He said it is an acausal connection between two events. And so acausal means you can't say X caused Y. And so as an example, you know, a synchronicity, the other day, you know, we had just gotten back to California after having been away, and we were relating a story about synchronicity, which dealt with a phrase from The Lord of the Rings, and the phrase is, not all those who wander are lost. And so, you know, we had been talking about this, and I ended up randomly at Hertz, and as I walked in, this guy standing there turns to me and says, there you are. Did you know that not all those who wander are lost? And he said the exact phrase, you know, that we had been talking about with regards to a totally different synchronicity. Now, what was the causal connection? Well, we can't say, but it turns out that if we're a computer-simulated world, then you know, the way things are stored in computers are based on association. And there's a gentleman named Jacques Vallée who you know, right?
He also wrote a blurb for your book.
He did, yeah. And so he and I were talking about this. And, you know, he's also a computer scientist. He made the first map of Mars for NASA back in the 60s before he was involved with, you know, Alan Hynek and Project Blue Book. And, you know, he makes the point that, okay, in a library, we would store everything based on physical space, like the A, the book's authors begin with A, then B, then C, then D. But if we were to store all of that information in a computer, we would store it associatively. So we would associate different things together in the computer as a way of retrieving that information. So in with synchronicity, it in a simulation, it could just be that's how it's organized. So the fact that we were saying one phrase and that this guy, random guy at the Hertz, said that same phrase right to me is because that's how the code itself is organized. And if I could, you know, there's a great story that happened recently with Jacques. And I actually wasn't there, so I didn't even know about it, but it was all related to this book and synchronicity and the Matrix. So he was giving a workshop in Big Sur, and he showed a couple of slides about, you know, this about my book and the idea that we could all be living in a simulation. And so then they broke for lunch, and everybody, you know, went out to lunch. And who was there but Lawrence Fishburne, you know, the actor?
Yeah, who was in The Matrix.
In The Matrix. And so they all told me about it afterwards. And I thought, well, that's an interesting...
Now, see, that is synchronicity. Riz, we're going to take a quick break. We'll come back and talk more about your work, the simulation hypothesis, and we'll also open up the phone lines. We'll give you an opportunity to make a phone call to Riz Virk right here on Coast to Coast AM.